vested interest. So that would be difficult. But if you're, I'm perceiving your question as any one of the national title insurers that are out there have yet come to Oregon, come knocking on our door, there'd be no change as far as the ease of getting into Oregon. It certainly would be easier for them once they were established here because their ability to jointly maintain, but I really view under existing law they can jointly maintain anyway. This is really a clarification language, a ratification, if you will, the two shells that we referred to earlier in the first line of the proposed amendment, June 24th.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Okay, let it give me more. Yeah.
Before I move the amendments, Mr. Chairman, I would like to see if the committee, if I'm the only one who shares the concern about the 10-year period of time, and see if the committee might look at that, considering, due to the hard times, let's not say 5 years, but maybe amending it to say 7 years. I think that gives a business person adequate time to divest themselves of that interest without giving them, hopefully, the very difficult period of time we're having now. I wouldn't want that to happen too immediately because I think they do need some time. But I would move to amend the amendments on page 3. It's line 3 of page 3 to change the word 10 years to 7 years.
I was not present at the meeting of the Land Title Association, so I'm not acquainted, Mr. Chairman and Representative Roberts, with why the 10 years. As I recall, there was some mention made of a family ownership on one of them where possibly they needed that long to divest themselves, but I assume that it could be done in 7 years, you know, just as well as 10. I don't know that where the figure got to be 10. I just wasn't there.
I'm not attempting to be difficult, and I wouldn't want to make it too soon because I do know these are not good times to be moving anything. But, you know, hopefully within a 7-year period of time that would not be the case and would allow them to rid themselves of that property without taking a financial loss, I would think, in a period of 7 years.
Okay. Can I move that?
Yes, I have moved that, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Further discussion? Get one.
Mr. Chairman, I was going to attempt to share with Representative Roberts only my insight on that, on her question. I was present at the convention for about 24 hours, and in the afternoon before I arrived, the agent section had a lengthy meeting in drafting the amendments you now see before you, and the concerns in the 10 years, I believe, emanated from the concerns of agents as opposed to underwriters. Now, that's my perception from some of the discussion that I heard, but as to precisely why 10, I'm sorry, the division could not render insight other than mere conjecture that obviously it's closed the door behind the last one with a vested interest.
Yeah, that's right. Very possible. That's the reason I generally pick something that's 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, and it's really easy to move from 5 years to 10 years when the 10 years might not be necessary just because it's the next step we tend to think of in numbers in the society. And I think that 7 years is quite, you know, when you think of the people being given 6 months in some settings to divest themselves before they go into federal employ and so forth, those 7 years seems an extensive amount of time to allow someone to make that divestiture without taking a financial loss.
Further discussion? Any objections?
No. Chairman, I will move the proposed amendments dated June 24th with the amendment on page 3 to House Bill 3171.
Any discussion?
The Legislative Council now will be cleaned up. And
yes, it will.
That's all.
Okay.
I'll distribute a copy, Mr. Chairman, of the cleanup amendments to you before we drop the report.
Okay, clerk, call it on.
Aye.
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 Aye. Motion passed.
Mr. Chairman, I would move House Bill 3171 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Discussion? Clerk, call it on.
Aye. Aye.
Dolan?
Yes.
Pardon me.
Parkinson? Aye.
Robert?
Aye.
Aye.
I want to thank the committee for their patience on all this, too.
I hope someone will call Mr. DeCourcy.
Maybe we can set you up tomorrow already. You just want to go over
this bill. Is that his name, DeCourcy?
No, that's the guy from Josephine County who's been here every day and then
are you? Who's going to carry it?
He'll get up and grab it.
Are you going to carry it?
He's been here day after day waiting for us to do this.
Okay.
Isn't this the bill? Same guy.
Yeah, that's the guy who, what did he call me? Cooks or whatever. I hope he didn't recuperate from that yet.
Yeah, before us now, Senate Bill 31.
Or Sweetie. Or
what happened to Markham?
Yeah, what happened to Markham?
Yeah, where's Markham?
Come back to that.
No, we won.
Mr. Chairman, while members of the committee, while Mr. Bassinet is coming forward, I just have a letter from Representative DeBoer's constituent to distribute to you about House Bill 2087.
I don't know. I never remember numbers.
I believe them, too.
Well, I haven't seen it yet.
Mr. Chairman and ladies and gentlemen of the committee, I'm Tom Bassinet with Oregon Mutual Insurance Company. On Senate Bill 31, I am more or less filling a commitment that I made to the Interim Committee on Judiciary by testifying before you on this bill. I've indicated in my marking that I'm neither in favor nor in opposition to this bill. I hate mandated coverages, and that's what this bill is doing to some extent. Let me give you just a little bit of background. What we're going to be talking about is automobile insurance. Under today's law, the mandated coverages, as you know, are liability insurance of $15,000 per person, $30,000 per accident for bodily injury, and $5,000 for property damage. In addition to that, you have to have personal injury protection, which covers the medical expenses and wage losses and essential services in the car, for the passengers in the car. Plus, you have to have uninsured motorist coverage for $15,000 and $30,000 for the people in your car if you are hit by a driver who is at fault and has no insurance. Now, those are the mandated coverages to date. There have been several attempts to increase the liability limits from $15,000 and $30,000 per person to $25,000 and $50,000 per person. Now, 31 is an alternative to that. Probably the greatest complaints you hear about the automobile insurance. I've kept a straight face anyway for a while.
I wonder why this
Bill 31.
Gosh.
Under the prior administration of the insurance commissioner's office, they had what was termed a mandatory offering and an option to buy for uninsured motorist coverage. Now, uninsured motorist is for bodily injury only. And you could buy up to your policy limits if you had increased your liability limits to protect yourself for the financial responsibility of colliding with somebody and injuring them. You could carry an increased limit there. And if you did, you could also increase your uninsured motorist to cover the passengers in your own car should the other party not have insurance, up to the limit of your own liability policy. Logic dictated that if you were willing to protect the other party for $100,000 liability, for instance, it was only logical that you should be able to protect your own loved ones in your car up to that same amount of money. However, if the other party had a $15,000 liability policy, it would not allow you then to collect your $100,000 because they did, in fact, have insurance and they were not insured.
Right.
So what this bill actually does is allows you to buy what is called under insurance to fill that gap. I'll use a figure. Let's assume that the other party is at fault and you have an injury in your car that is worth $100,000 and you have $100,000, $300,000 liability limits. If the party was not insured, you would collect $100,000 from your own insurance company under the uninsured motorist coverage. But if the individual did have any insurance, then you would not be able to collect under the uninsured motorist. However, with this offering of insurance, if you bought the under insurance to go along with your higher limits of uninsured motorist, you would then have $100,000 coverage. You would collect $15,000 from the wrongdoer. Your own insurance company then would pay you $85,000, making you totally well financially. And that's what this bill does. It allows you the option of buying that type of coverage. It's first party benefits. Now, this I might add to those of you who are interested in increasing the financial responsibility law from $15,000 to $25,000, this is, I think, a better alternative. The reason I say it's better as an alternative is because so many of the people that are carrying $15,000 and $30,000 or the basic limits of liability are the low socioeconomic level people or the fixed income families, and therefore they can't afford a 25% increase in their premium to go to $25,500, which the bill, other bills ask for. But this does provide that those people who can afford it and want to buy the protection can, in fact, protect themselves and their loved ones. Yeah. So that's the purpose of this bill. Now, I might say that about 50% of the companies doing business in the state of Oregon already make this coverage available to the policyholders. So it is not dislocating the insurance industry by forcing it. However, it does not apply until after the effective date of January 1, 1982, because that gives the insurance industry time, those who are not writing it, time to crank in an endorsement into their policy and then make it available for those policies renewed after that date.
Mr. Chairman, I got a question. In your opinion, would this be a mandated insurance bill?
Well, yes and no. It's mandatory that the insurance company makes it available to the public. It's optional as to whether or not the insurance public buys the coverage.
You see what I'm saying? It's a shell offer.
So it's a shell offer, yes, or mandatory offering.
Another question. It looks like this would do nothing but be good for business. Why would any company presently not offer it?
That's a very good question. I don't know why they would not offer it because, about 50% of the carriers now offer it, and they have an edge on the market if the people are aware that it is available to them. Because I would not drive a car without it, personally.
How the hell do we know if we got it?
Ask your agent.
Tom, but what was the need of the introduction of this bill, actually? You know?
It was an alternative to increasing the Financial Responsibility Act. To 25 and 50, which there are two bills in the Senate that are now dead as a result of this bill moving forward. They say this is a good alternative to increasing the financial responsibility.
Well, what happened to the other bills you said?
They're dead.
They're dead.
Yeah, the ones to go from from 15,000 to 25,000 liability are dead.
Industry wants this?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman.
Well, not only industry wants this, no.
Everybody?
No. There's no opposition to it, but not everybody's excited about passing it, is what I'm saying.
Could you speak to page 1, line 16, where it talks about the maintenance part?
Maintenance or use of an automobile?
Yeah,
motor vehicle.
Speak to that.
Okay, that's a catchphrase. Basically speaking, rising out of an accident of the ownership or maintenance and use of a motor vehicle. Let's assume that you have opened the hood on the car and take the radiator cap off when it's extremely hot and it scorches you, it burns you very badly. That's maintenance of the automobile and is therefore covered under the policies to date. You're not, as an example, you're not in the automobile, you're not upon the automobile, you're maintaining the automobile. You jack a car up and it falls off the jack. There is court cases that say that's the maintenance of an automobile. Another court case said that automobile is, in fact, upon you.
Okay.
you're not in it. It's upon you when it falls on you. So it's a phrase that has been used for the maintenance of an automobile. Also, there are those people who are blind who actually do not drive an automobile, hopefully. But they do maintain an automobile for their own use. And this catches them as to their liabilities should they be involved in a crash where they have somebody driving for them.
Okay, can we take it a step further and say I have my car worked on in a service station and they do something that causes me to go down the street and my wheel comes off or something. Okay. Would then my insurance be the first one that you apply to in this case, or would it be a suit, their insurance?
The auto policy would be the first to respond.
Okay.
To the that. Now, yes, your automobile policy would respond immediately to the accident. Then they would attempt to pull the repairing facility into the litigation, either as a recovery against them or as a prime defendant. If the automobile dealer was driving the car, of course, then their policy would be primary and would cover first.
Okay. Probably causes you to go to a different service station.
Mr. Chairman?
Probably one of Mr. Moulton's
back there. A couple of questions. The wheel falling off, is that germane to this bill?
It could be. If, as an example, and I would have to use it as illustrative only, let's assume that a service station put the wheel on and didn't tighten the lug nuts up, and you were driving down the road and you had a bad crash as a result of it, and your injuries were far more than the service station's insurance policy, then yes, it would be germane because this would pick up that differential.
And my second question, Mr. Chairman, right now, kind of dumb, I guess. Does everyone have to carry uninsured motorist coverage?
Yes.
That's mandatory now.
Mandatory coverage.
Thank you. That's all.
Any more questions, Tom? Tom,
go ahead. No, that's it.
Okay.
Anyone else to testify?
No, nobody else.
So. Accept a motion on the bill?
Yes.
I move A. N. Gross Senate Bill 31 to the floor of the due pass recommendation.
Discussion.
Any discussion?
I am not ready to do that yet. I'm having a little trouble figuring where this is any different than a lot of other mandated bills that I've voted against. It looks to me like if people want to buy this kind of insurance, it's there for them to buy.
That's
worth. I don't know why we should be requiring them to have this coverage.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it doesn't require anybody to have the coverage. It requires the insurance companies to offer the coverage.
Yes, I
and
understand.
And so it's a shall offer approach to this question. It's not a mandate. The only mandate is that they have to offer it.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman. He can say anything he wants right now. He doesn't have an employer.
Go get him.
Frank, go ahead. What are you testifying for?
My name is Frank Howitt, Mr. Chairman, and I'm just testifying for myself as an individual. Just a word of background on this. Several years ago, it was common for only the $15,000 of uninsured motorist coverage to be offered. And $15,000 is the financial responsibility limit. And so people generally would only have $15,000 of uninsured motorist coverage, even if they had larger liability limits. And obviously, if the person who was responsible in the accident had $15,000 of coverage, then the uninsured motorist coverage did not come into play. If the person did not have any insurance, your uninsured motorist coverage provided up to $15,000. Where the problem started was when the insurance commissioner, Lester Rawls, thought that people should have the opportunity to provide the higher limits of uninsured motorist coverage to up to the liability limits under their own policy, so that a person could protect himself or herself to the same extent that they protect other people with their liability limits. And I regard it really as an oversight in that original law that mandates the higher limits of uninsured motorist coverage to be offered, and that's in your law now. It was an oversight that did not provide as part of that law that if the other person had something other than zero insurance, in other words, $1, $2, $15,000, that the uninsured motorist coverage would make up the difference. You've got a discontinuity now. If the other person has no insurance, you get 100% of the uninsured motorist coverage. If the other person has $1 of insurance, you get nothing. It doesn't make any sense. This is really in the nature of a technical correction. Now, there are a lot of fine points and refinements, and I haven't seen all the amendments, but that's the basic issue. It removes that discontinuity in the benefits under the uninsured motorist coverage. And I think it's very valuable. You can just imagine a person who carries $300,000 of uninsured motorist coverage and gets hit by a person with $15,000 of insurance, how the injured person is going to feel when he finds out that all he can collect, or she can collect, is $15,000. It doesn't make sense.
Thank you, Frank. Frank.
Mr. Chairman, I think it's a good bill. I'm going to support the bill. Are you still going to move the motion?
Yeah, the motion is still on the table.
Okay.
Any further discussion? Clerk, call the roll.
Representative
Bradbury.
Aye.
Dubois.
Aye.
Jolin.
Aye.
Markham?
Aye.
Aye.
Roberts?
Aye.
Mr. Chairman?
Aye. Motion passed.
It seems appropriate that Representative Markham ought to carry this bill. He should have some sentimental attachment to that bill. I just...
If we can all keep ourselves from laughing when it's cut off.
We'll have to wear a trench coat.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, maybe this could be put on the mutual consent calendar. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, would you like to put on the consent calendar, or do you feel like someone needs to carry it? Someone needs to carry it.
I don't think it ought to be on the consent calendar.
I would like to carry it, then, Mr. Chairman.
Anybody? No, I don't want to carry it.
I don't want to carry it. Yep. I'll carry it.
Okay. Yes, good. Mr. Chairman, how about House Bill 3171? We just passed out title insurance. Who would like to carry that one?
You're not in the Becky, too.
No, I think Becky said she was going to carry it, didn't you?
I'll take one or the other. Somebody bite them up. Whoever wants. I'll take the other one. I don't care.
I'm carrying quite a few bills out of revenue in the next few days. It would be helpful for me if somebody else is not burdened
I'll
down.
I'll take them.
Mr. Chairman, Senate Bill 508. Keith Burns.
Senate Bill 508.
Okay, I'm excited, but I think I'm going to carry part of it.
I'll take 31.
31? Okay. All right. Thank you.
Consumer bill.
Yeah, it's another good consumer bill.
Another, what is it? What's your word?
Stunning bill.
Keith, there's a copy.
I saw it, Mr.
Vice Chairman, before you came into the room. Send this down to the folks. This is a little less human.
Oh, this is the one.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Keith Burns, and on this bill I represent the American Council of Life Insurance, the Oregon Association of Life Insurance Companies, and with me is Dr. Forrest Richard, who is the head of the life actuaries for Standard Insurance Company here in Oregon. I will briefly explain the objectives of this bill. I will not explain how it achieves these objectives. Mr. Frank Howitt is here also. He took this model bill and put it into form and style for the National Association of Insurance Commissioners prior to its introduction, and is also very familiar with the bill. And also here is Mr. Isham from the Insurance Division. This bill was introduced by my clients at the behest of the Insurance Division and the National Association of Insurance Commissioners because it was approved in its final form subsequent to the time that the Insurance Division would have had to file it as a pre-session filed bill. quick observation of the bill would indicate to you that it's long and complicated, and it's dealing with a subject that most of us are not very familiar with. It's the non-forfeiture benefits and reserves of life insurance policies. This non-forfeiture law sets forth requirements life insurance companies must meet to sell their policies in this state. There have not been any changes in this area except for adapting to the change in interest rates and mortality tables since the 1960s. This bill provides for more flexibility in assumed interest rates and determining policy reserves and the cash values and other non-forfeiture benefits. It takes into consideration present-day interest rates. It does not set interest rates. It doesn't establish mortality tables. It merely adapts to those, however they may change. It changes the mortality table used from the 1958 mortality table to the 1980 mortality table, just because it happened to occur within the framework of when this was being developed. It covers life insurance products now being sold but not anticipated under the present law. In other words, it fills some cracks that exist in the present law. It provides the insurance commissioner with authority to deal with new products that may be in variance with this law as they appear in the marketplace, that is, in the future. In summary, it updates interest and mortality assumptions, the assumptions that they would have in determining the assets that the insurance company must have to meet its obligations and the benefits, and it will tend to lower premiums on life insurance and will give the insurance commissioner better regulatory authority. It's recommended by our insurance division and the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. It's recommended by the American Council of Life Insurance and the Oregon Association of Life Insurance Companies, the National Life Underwriters, and the Oregon Life Underwriters. Nobody testified against the bill on the Senate side. It passed the bill from the committee unanimously, and there were no negative votes on the Senate floor. There were two people absent. Senator McCoy carried the bill. Mr. Howitt was on the sidelines to answer any questions. There were none. It's a needed bill. It's not a controversial bill. It's a difficult bill to understand that only a specialized actuary can fully explain. And there were extensive hearings on the Senate side where there was actuaries that helped develop the bill from Washington, D.C., along with Dr. Richard was present, and Mr. Howitt all testified in on the bill and addressing any questions the committee had. So that's the history of the bill, why it's here, who supports it, and you'll find no opposition to the bill. And Dr. Rich will answer any questions you have. Mr. Howe is here to also answer questions, and Mr. Isham from the Insurance Division.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Robert.
Why would the bill lower life insurance rates?
Why don't you introduce yourself to the table?
Yeah, my name is Forrest Richin. I'm employed by Standard Insurance Company, and I'm an actuary. It would permit development of life insurance policies at lower premium rates because I've got to back up just a minute. The state has an obligation, and through the law that this bill amends, has set up standards for minimum reserve liabilities for certain types of life insurance contracts, so that if I, as an insurance company, issue a policy on your life, then since that's a long-term contract that requires me to pay the death benefit whenever you die, be that close in time or way off in the future, I've got to set up and build a reserve as an assurance to the state that I'm solvent enough to pay off my claims. The reserves are calculated using assumed mortality tables and interest rates. Now, historically, interest rates have been quite low, and as a measure of conservatism, the state has permitted, has put a lid on the interest rate that you can assume. And years ago, the maximum permitted rate was 3%. During the last 10 years, that rate has been increased a couple of times during the 1970s. With each increase in rates, That lowers the reserve liability that I, as an insurance company, am required to hold. So the point of this now is that with the increased interest rate, I can now issue a policy with a lower reserve liability. And since the liability is lower, I don't have to collect as much premium to fund that liability.
See, this is the interest rate they would get on investing the money.
Yeah.
And under the present law, you can't change fast enough. You have to come back to the state and get statutory authority. This would permit them to fluctuate the assumed interest rate as interest rates change.
Could I approach it briefly just one other way?
Okay.
When we entered the decade of the 70s, I believe the maximum rate was at 3%. No, it would have been 3.5%, I'm sorry. Then twice during the 70s, through the NAIC model bill procedure, the state of Oregon and other states increased the maximum rate two times, once up to 4%, and then it's currently at 4.5%. As a result of each of those increases, life insurance companies, including my own, did develop a revised set of policies where the premium rates did go down. So I approached it from a theoretical point of view before looking historically. That's actually what has happened.
In looking at the trends as they change in terms of living longer in your actuarial tables, speaking to that, as they're reflected, as those
time on the New York companies, because this will permit us to lower rates. And that is what has happened historically when this law has been changed in the 70s, too. I'm driving people away.
Are we going to get this thing out here today?
I have to go up and testify and
see if Bill Bradbury is outside.
I'd like to call him.
Frank Howard, I want to testify.
Yeah.
Okay.
Drag him up.
Yeah. I'll be
right.
He's coming.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I see Frank Howard. You want to testify to him? You want to testify to him? Oh, okay. Okay.
I'll get Frank to carry it on the floor.
Check, you want to?
No, I have nothing to say but keep the faith.
Yeah. Okay, why don't you move
on a motion?
Yeah.
You guys ready to move this house? Chairman, I'll move Senate Bill 508A and Gross to the floor. Do pass.
Any discussion? Clerk, call the roll.
Representative Bradford.
Aye.
DuBois.
Aye, as long as I don't have to carry it.
No.
Jolin. Markham.
Aye.
Parkinson. Robert. Mr. Chairman.
Aye, wish you best.
I appreciate your understanding, or I should say your attempt to understand this very complicated bill.
Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
You got a pitch written out to carry it?
Yep.
I don't particularly care to carry any bill. We'll find out about it.
What you do? What you do?
Is that it for the day?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I have two quick items I'd like to bring to your attention. We could close the hearing, though.
We close the hearing. Thanks very much.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, two brief items of information. One, at the hearing the other day, it was my understanding that there was some general agreement that in Senate Bill 484, the provision that when two people filed for a divorce, that the county clerk would have a little mimeographed piece of paper that would say, notice if your spouse has a group insurance policy, you may be available for some kind of conversion, and you should just check it. That provision of 484 was generally agreeable to the committee. A couple of members asked us to find a bill that we could put that amendment into that was in another committee. And there is such a bill, Senate Bill 835,
in-house judiciary, and it has a hearing coming up on Friday at 3:30.
I'm going to go.
Okay.
So what does 8:35 do? Is it
sponsored by the Older Women's League and deals with general same issues. It'd be very compatible.
Is it going to come out of the committee?
I believe it is. That's my understanding. Yeah. At least we'll know on Friday. And the second item, just to ask for some direction, if you care to give me any, AOI has come out in opposition to our committee bill of regulatory flexibility, and in their explanation, some of the points, from my perspective, were totally erroneous. They talked about state agencies under federal guidelines, and our bill is modeled after the federal legislation that's already passed.
Why don't you run out and ask? I can come in and explain that position. Congleton.
And I understand they're very divided, but in any event, the bill is coming up for hearing and trade on Monday.
Congleton, AOI. So. See if AOI is in the hall. Congleton.
You know, I can read that. The National Federation
you
of Independent Business.
You have a copy of their comment on...
Well, they came... Let me tell you how the first time I heard about it was right before it went to the floor for a vote, and they were sitting out in the hall, and someone said, did I realize that there was conflict with the Forest Practices Act.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, why weren't you in there? Well, we didn't know about it.
But Forestry Department was here, and they asked the question about the effect, and when we explained the amendment where possible, they said, oh, then that's fine.
Yeah.
That was Department of Forestry.
Right, yeah.
Department of Forestry.
Well, and if they want to put in some amendments to the bill
sure.
that say that the Forest Practices Act is not subject to these provisions, we don't mm-hmm. care.
And we can do that, but they were satisfied with
they
what
they sent out a letter that just
they really slammed it.
I know it, and I don't think that was fair, really.
Mm-hmm.
I am. I'm going to go through some.
We want to ask you a question.
Sure.
We passed that bill out.
House Bill 3284, Regulatory Flexibility.
3274?
84, I believe.
3284. Okay, I don't know anything about that.
Regulatory flexibility.
Okay, no, I don't know anything about that one. Okay. You want me to get Ike and ask Ike to come
in?
We thought it might be 3274, which was the other bill that had to do with special rules or study of small rules for small
businesses. That's the bill we're talking
about. That's the bill.
Okay, that's the bill. That's 3274.
It may be 70.
Yeah.
Okay.
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 What is the objection of that?
Okay.
Why don't you share with them?
What our concern is, and we're trying to work it out with the small business people, and we think that we have, is that the forest practice rules and the rules to deal with fire and insect and disease, those rules are all, as they relate to administration, are all specific design criterion acts. They you know, it says, don't cross the road, don't do this, and don't do that.
Yeah.
Well, the way that this is, the whole bill is written, is that some group could come in and counter to that, saying we want performance standards for those rules rather than design criteria.
Uh-huh.
So what we've been busy with John McCulley and those are changing that Section C, and they came up with some really good wording using design criteria for setting standards,
right.
or objective criteria.
Right.
You probably have seen that.
Right. Yeah.
And then the other one that we were looking at, there was two options. If you take that amendment right there and change that and delete the word small as opposed and just say business, then that takes care of all the forestry problems. Okay, the second option is to say that nothing in these chapters or in this law applies to fire protection, Forest Practices Act, and insect and disease. And then that takes care of those things that are very specific criteria.
The reason we brought it up is just the hearing on Monday, and there's been a lot of concern raised about why is there opposition and can it be worked out and straightened out.
Yeah, and Department of Forestry comes just from where we are because it would...
Yeah.
See, from our standpoint, Max, Oregon's Forest Practices Act is very, very reasonable to work with, but yet very effective. If you know, it's got a 99.8% compliance ratio. It's very high. And what happens under that is that because it's so effective, that we're able to hold the cost down to comply with environmental standards. So in Oregon, our logging costs are probably less than $1 per thousand to the landing. And in California, they're over $30 per thousand to landing. And that's why we want to protect this, because the rules that they are designed to fit everybody regardless of size. But yet it would be possible to have performance standards.
But we could have within those amendments though. I mean,
Max,
we were dealing with a bill.
Yeah, and this is, frankly, we did not catch it until it had already come out of committee, and that's why we didn't fight a battle on the floor. We had talked a little bit to Bill Martin, yeah, a little bit to Bradbury, mm-hmm, just for a couple of minutes, but then we stayed out of it because I think the people that I talked with knew that we would try and put some amendments, sure, over there. We just got here too late, and that's...
Is it still in committee?
It's got a hearing Monday.
Treating and it's our regulatory flexibility.
We can take care of that. I mean, you know, because we want the bill for the rest.
Yeah, right.
I think it's a good bill.
So what we're going to do is, in fact, I was just waiting to talk to Mike because we want to go and see. We think the first one, taking the word small out, so it just applies to business. And then the second thing, objective criteria, then that would resolve all the problems, I think, that we can see in the sense of relating to the specific rules and the problems in the
plan. Well, we just exclude altogether.
Mm-hmm. Or go the other option, you know, exclude the forestry.
Exclude that. That's easier.
Yeah. Well, let me explain the problem on the in Section 5 by not changing the word or taking the word small business out and making it apply to business. You're setting up double standards. For every business under 50 has one standard, over 50 has another standard, and what you're going to find, I think, on Monday is the agencies are going to come in and say there's a cost impact. When you got the bill up on the House floor, fiscal staff said no cost impact. I think you're going to find at the hearing Monday that there's going to be agencies coming in and say there's substantial cost impact because of having to promulgate and review rules on the basis of two different standards. You can eliminate that double standard problem by just removing the word small.
Yeah. Okay.
And then the other...
Okay, well, that is all right then. And then
there's the design standards and performance standards also have another problem, I understand, with some agencies over in the Department of Commerce. Uh-huh. There are, I think the electrical code, elevator code, and some groups like that are design standards and not performance standards too. So it just isn't the Department of Forestry, it's other areas. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that's why if we would make that change to Section C, say objective criteria will be used to set design standards and delete the word small, I think probably all the concerns that we've raised.
Well, one call we had in your article, if I remember it said it would be impossible for some agency under federal directives to comply. And I didn't understand the logic for that, since it's modeled after the federal. I mean, if there are federal directives on state agencies, they too are guided by the federal legislation.
Well, that comes from Bill Young.
Yeah.
And the truth of the matter is, some of the companies they have that are the worst polluters in Oregon employ less than 50 people. Right. We can't set standards on the basis of small and big. Divided in 50.
Okay.
Committee again.
Now there's another.